Thank you. investigation. That includes ethics, dream death, and back towards the end. The bear is our researcher. Others will then come in. They will introduce themselves as they come in. I will then allow honorable members to introduce themselves. After that, it will be the DJ's team and whoever is a guest coming outside the department will also do that. Over to you, honorable members.
Good morning. It's Esther Susan Talekwae, member of the Committee on Health. Thank you.
Changed the structure and created what I would describe as almost like a flat structure where they called everybody, whether you're a super, a cleaner, a pathology officer, they call them the same thing. So over the years, that is the first thing. The second is that when that function also was transferred, forensic pathology officers used to get danger allowance when they were with South African Public Service. on during the transit. So in the past years, we were approached by Labour raising these concerns, saying that one, they are performing the function for which they are not trained and they are not competent. At the heart of this dispute is the fact that forensic pathology officers say that they are expected to dissect a cadaver or bodies that are prepared for autopsy. And in their opinion, the pathologists no longer provide proper supervision. So what we did, we then consulted the two provinces that were deemed to be having retained the original structure, Eastern Cape and Western Cape, and requested that they give us those structures so that the other provinces revert back to the normal structures that were originally in place. But secondly, we also asked the provinces to go back and implement the structures so that it was no longer flat. We prepared regulations so that we could have this as a regulated environment. And more recently, as far back as last week, we went to the bargaining chamber to agree on the plan. Chair, there are a number of areas where we think, and I know that I'll say provinces, it shows even with the disparities, two provinces follow a particular approach, other seven do something else. It needs a regulated environment. So we've got these draft regulations that we'll share with Parliament. Secondly, we thought that it was inappropriate for the gender allowance to have been withdrawn if indeed a forensic pathology officer is to be beneficiaries of this gender allowance. And I would argue that yes, indeed they are exposed to danger. They are exposed to danger, Chair, because I've seen and experienced this with the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. This was the basis of the spread of disease, and actually that what led to the loss of life of four workers in West Africa. So forensic pathology officers and people who work in that environment need protective clothing. They not only need protective clothing, they also need counseling from time to time, because they on an ongoing basis deal with dead bodies and it's traumatic. So we've come up with an argument with Labour that one, the original structure must be implemented by all the provinces. Two, forensic pathology officers must have a career path, meaning they must also be trained, because most of them are not trained, it's learning through doing. They must have proper supervision, they must have counseling, they must be given a danger allowance, and those who dissect will also be given what they call dissection allowance, because it's very specific, it's not just general. So we have considered all of that, and I think it will normalize the situation across the whole country. But in addition, Chair, housing has had, within one province, there was an absence of practice. In the southern part of the province, there was what I would term good behavior, that there was supervision by mental officers and pathologists. But in the northern part of the province, that was not the case. So all those matters have been resolved, and the this implementation. Yesterday, the minister had a teleconference with all the MECs to just get them to every one of them to say, yes, they will implement this decision that was approved. I think this is the same.
No, thank you very much, DG. I think it's an information that is very important for us as public representatives, in particular for those that are in health. At least we will then be able to, if we are to respond, we respond at least being informed and hoping that that provinces will adhere to all what has been agreed upon. And I think on behalf of the committee, we humbly request that there should be monitoring of this process so that we don't go back. We don't go back to the situation. It's quite traumatic. It gives an impression that government doesn't care, and those workers, whom you are correct by saying they are exposed to danger, as if they are insensitive. The others have lost their loved one, so it's quite a very emotive situation. But we're happy that also the Department of Health nationally is part of that. I don't know whether there are any
thank you very much. It's just I only need to advise on one point about the agreement with the labor people. To say there has been people who have been doing this job, even though they were not trained, which means they don't have a certificate on the work that they were doing. So if you can add on and say certification through assessment based on the experience, so that they can also be acknowledged in the job that they are doing, but it's not included as part and parcel of this.
Sorry, did you honor the
change? Thank you, Chair. I also just want to find out how long is the process going to be for all the provinces to comply with the new regulations that you've done for the Chair? In terms of like the Western Cape only. Thank you, Chairperson. And I just want to thank the Department for the speedy intervention, because it was very relevant to those implications, like the Chairperson just alluded to. I just wanted to find out, in terms of the budget, is there a budget implication to the department, because of these allowances? Are they also going to be capable to, is it budgeted for already, or what is it that's been happening to accommodate it going forward? Because if it's not part of the budget, it's going to be a problem.
The last one, just for myself, I think what Honorable Tinubayo was raising was if the department can take a look into the recognition of violence, because obviously those workers have been there, or they've acquired skills, they need polishing. So the issue of the recognition of prior learning, if that can be taken care of. But over to you, Chair.
Okay, Chair, I'll start with the question on the budget, and I'll work backwards. Mm-hmm. There's a total of 1,008 people who are affected. I say people precisely because some are correctly designated as forensic pathology officers, which is a title that is befitting, and there are others that, like who are cleaners and so on, who should not have been designated as forensic pathology officers. Now, the number of people who are transferred from South African Police Services is just over 300. It's not a lot. And that was in 2006. And over that period, there's been attrition, others have passed on, and so on. So the latest number we had, and I think it will still be very precise, about 95, means those who should have had that allowance when they transferred, But going forward, we're talking about 1,008 health workers. And we've done the sum, and if we do a breakdown per province, even that is money that can be absorbed by provinces. I'm talking about probably around the range of about 150,000 per province. Just doing a back of the envelope calculation is actually not a lot of money for the type of work that these health workers are exposed to. I think provinces should be able to absorb that. The second, Chair, about recognition of prior learning. In fact, what happened in this process, there was a curriculum developed for training for them to have long-term BTEC degrees. So it means the new entrants will be trained, will qualify, because they have said so, that they need a career pathing so that they can also be recognized. And I think the dispute at hand is that pathologists need to supervise them. But the supervision should be for those who also have certain requisite skills and qualifications. So far, Chair, today the only university that provides training is the Cape Peninsular University of Technology. We are talking with other universities about them providing formal training. But there will obviously be recognition of training for those who have been doing this work for years. I think there will not be. At the moment, the focus is that whilst they do this work, they need to be supervised. I think that is at the heart of the debate and discussion. But for us, Chair, this is we have come up with regulations, but we've also written the Health Professions Council to start a process of coming up with a scope of practice and recognizing that this is a professional where people must not just wake up and, you know, do their sessions and so on. They must have certain skills. So, like I say, at the heart of debate and discussion is that they are saying they will only do their session if they are recognized and if that function has certain value attached to it. And I think this is what you said, yes, it actually is a problem. It should be so.
Well, thank you very much. We have been joined. Can you please let me introduce yourself using the mic?
My name is Sheila Basel and I work in the Office of the Deputy Speaker.
Thank you very much for coming. KZN?
Chair, thank you very much. With regard to KZN, you may have noticed that there was quite a lot in the news. We actually, Chair, got a formal communication from health workers themselves requesting us to intervene. And that was 2 months ago. And I led a delegation to KZN to go and investigate what the issues were. And I just want to confirm, Chair, that it is indeed a very disturbing situation. In that over the years, it seems with an attempt to try and meet audit outcomes and to perform, KZN has deliberately and increasingly and continuously frozen posts and abolished, meaning out of a certain number of posts, so that in the audit books, in this board, they freeze, abolish, to an extent that they've actually literally are running on, I don't want to say autopilot, I describe it as they are in ICU without ventilators. I say they are in ICU without ventilators because over a number of years, if you have a certain number of posts, when they are vacated, you don't fill them. You freeze them and abolish them. You're going to increase needy youth out of SARS. That is the first problem. The second shared is that for the number of specialist posts, you first have to have registrant posts who have to be in training to become future specialists. So what has happened there is that registrant posts have also been repeatedly again frozen, abolished. But what they've done is that they then created what they call supernumerary posts. Now, supernumerary posts are posts for foreigners, meaning we are training foreign people to be specialists, but we are freezing posts for the training of South Africans. So this is the second problem. The third here is that they change their procurement processes, which are inconsistent with the provisions of the Treasury procurement rules. The threshold for procurement is that anything above 500,000 you go out on tender. Below 500,000 you must have a database and then have quotations. So they actually dropped that to between 30,000 and 200,000, meaning in hospitals they gave them a threshold of 200,000. But if you buy, if you're a CEO of a hospital, you want to buy anything, it's 30,000, they have to publish somewhere on a gazette in the province. Meaning they have actually tied the hands of the CEOs of the hospitals. And they, when we went to six different hospitals, they say they only have a budget of about 5,000 to buy any equipment. So obviously there's no equipment that is worth 5,000. So Chair, we have shared the report with the minister, with the MEC, so it's quite clear that we need to intervene. Obviously, not using the Section 100. So the team went there, sat down to reverse all the requirements that they have come up with that are inconsistent with Treasury regulations.
No, thank you very much. Because when KZN last week, KZN was the last province to take us through on the challenges of mental health. And what we then requested, remember what was on the public domain was the issue of oncologists. Now, the whole lot of some of the issues, they because maybe our concentration was on oncology, and we were in fact informed that there's a team from the National Department that is going to visit a province. So I was not quite sure which province is that. Until then, I was informed that it is then KZN. What I don't know what is your take on the issue of oncology. Because that's what the MEC took us through, apart from the other administrative issues.
Well, Chair, I want to say that it's not just oncology. KZN is one of the key training platforms for the production of medical students in this country. There are five departments that have lost their accreditation in KZN. And I recite them. One is oncology, hematology, orthopedic surgery, ENT, and urology. Now, the risk is that those registrars that are in training to become specialists, they will have to be moved elsewhere. So they have two campuses. One campus is in KZN, the other one, I mean, in the Durban, and the other one is. So it means they have to move everybody to be trained in. But the biggest problem at the moment is that because of lack of posts and because of lack of head of departments, the Health Professions Council has withdrawn accreditation. Now it has implications firstly for the training of undergraduates, it has instituted for the training of specialists. That's why I say it's a much bigger problem than just oncology. Now, the oncology one is because of this problem of accreditation. There are two problems. One is that Addison Hospital has machines that do not work because of the tender problems, the senior internment and so on, which are the subject of investigation actually by the accountant general. The second is the Chief Albert Bitudi, which has machines but does not have people. So the immediate thing is to take people that are in Addison, move them and see how we bring in specialist oncologists because there are staff. So we met with Professor Sulam last week. Professor Sulam is heading the oncology center here at Stellenbosch. He is a professor and the chair of the cancer advisory committee, ministerial advisory committee. So what Sulam is going to do, he's bringing in team that will provide support to people. And so he's just worked on a plan. We'll just look at what kind of additional resources are needed to implement that. So we'll interview, but this is, like I said, Chair, and I'm sorry to use such a graphic way to say ICU without any children.
No, thank you very much, DJ. I think as the committee at the appropriate time, we will see how things do move forward. Really need that we've got a long task because, as you are saying, KZN, one is just at the back. What's really happening in the States? What is happening in Northern Cape? What is happening in Western Cape? I'm just the health sector as a whole. So we really have got a long task, but thank you very much for that briefing. I think that as much as it is eating a little bit of our time, but it's an important briefing because things that are happening as we are seated here as public representatives. Having said that, we will then allow you to take us through the our agenda. Honourable members, we are going to take us on the presentation on the National Laboratory Services Amendment Bill.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start by saying thank you so much for inviting us to present on the bill. This bill is intended to separate functions between what is currently NHLS, which is supposed to provide the diagnostic laboratory services, from one that is supposed to perform functions that should help us meet our international obligations, international health regulations. So I have asked Dr. Peele to present.
Thank you, Gigi. Thank you, Honorable Chair and members. We structured the presentation such that we go through the history of the NHLS to understand how the NHLS was created, what are the challenges, and so the reason why we need an amendment. So I think if we can start in 94, after the first elections in 94, the Honourable Minister at the time, Dr. Zuma, appointed a task team to investigate services and to make a proposal around restructuring of lab services. At that time, the largest component of public laboratories was the SAIMR, the South African Institute for Medical Research. And this institute was established in 1912 and formalized the founding agreement in 1917. There were two parties to the agreement, were the Department of Health and the Chamber of Mines. There were other laboratories that were established by several homelands that we had at the time prior to 1994, and provincial administrations that were managed largely by the new provincial administration. So post-1994, the public health laboratory services were fragmented owing to these historical developments and policies. So laboratory services were not existent in the former homeland areas, as you can imagine, with the exception of KZN. So this resulted in huge dependence on the SAIMR for the provision of the services. So in provinces like Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and the Northwest, if a sample was to be collected, it had to be sent to a laboratory, to the SAIMR laboratory, and if that laboratory could not conduct the test, the process then ended there. There was no further referral. So at the time in 1998, the SAIMR became responsible for blood transfusion services in what was known then, sorry, as the old Transvaal. Further, provinces like Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and Northwest were not able to recruit and establish their own labs, largely because of the distribution of human resources across the country. Many of the experts didn't want to go into those provinces of work, and so we had difficulty doing that. This was compounded by the SAIMR refusing to provide transfusion services if the private sector was used for those services. In Limpopo, a batch of tests were compared with the private sector, and there were major discrepancies found in the accuracy of the testing, in other words, the quality of the test results. And so by 1998, the SAIMR became insolvent due to poor payments by provinces, so the SAIMR depended on the provinces for payments. So following extensive deliberation, the Health MINMEC, which for what it was called at the time, we now call it the MHC, a committee comprising of the Minister of Health and the 9 provincial MHCs responsible for health resolved at one, that owing to the poor state of laboratory services within the SAIMR, the provincial departments of health, the greater equity issues that Bidevil had through, as well as the need for a uniform and coordinated laboratory service, that a provincial model for the provision of laboratory services was not appropriate, and that all laboratory services comprising of the SAIMR, provincial laboratories, and homeland laboratories should be amalgamated into a single laboratory service. So the two major questions that then arose with the amalgamation was, firstly, whether do you privatize the service, do you nationalize it, or do you manage the service as a parastatus? And secondly, whether the ownership of the SAIMR as an existing institution, how does it happen? So the MINMEC resolved on the 2nd of October 1998 that the National Health Laboratory Service would be the parastatal organization. So the NHLS was created, and its objectives were, firstly, to address equity in access to laboratory services, secondly, to address capacity issues with respect to the ability to recruit specialized skills, particularly in the disadvantaged provinces, thirdly, to become the platform for teaching, training, and research relating to laboratory services, including that of the registrar, and then fourthly, to build and sustain a network of pathology services to meet the public health needs of the country. So there have been challenges in the establishment of NHLS, but I think it's important to also recognize some of the achievements. So there's been certainly been consolidation and strengthening of the laboratory services from what we had at the time in 1994. There's been improvement in infrastructure, improvements in access and the quality of services offered, teaching, training, and research structures as well. And it is the overall leadership and governance challenges that have posed some problems. So the problems and challenges can be probably summarized in the following. Leadership and governance challenges in the way the NHLS is structured. Its service delivery requirements versus the way it needs to run its organization as a business. The interface between the NHLS and its stakeholders. Here we're referring particularly to the reconciliation of billing, the gatekeeping role that is required between the NHLS and provinces, and then the debt management. The use of fee revenue to fund national functions, and also the poor internal control policies and controls. So these challenges have clearly undermined the efforts in establishing the NHLS from 2000. So the amendments that we're proposing are intended to deal with some of these challenges that we have in the NHLS as we have experienced it in the past. So if I can go to the first amendment, which is clause 1, and it proposes amendments to section 1 of the Act, by firstly the deletion of the definition of teaching environment as the expression we never use in the Act, so we didn't think it necessary to define it. But we do include clauses that have reference within the Act, and these are the National Health Council, the term prescribed, private health sector, and diagnostic health laboratory services, and to amend the expression of chief executive officer. So that's clause.
Sorry, Doc. I don't know, I want to propose a process that is going to assist all of us. As you are, and I hope members do have their copies, as you are having this presentation, if you can then direct us to the
okay.
I hope members do have copies of the book.
Which one is that?
So I'll start again with clause one. So clause one proposes amendment to section one of the Act. So that is on page two. Page two, maybe the numbers are the same, but page three. So it deletes firstly the teaching environment as an expression used, because teaching environment is not really referred to in the Act, so there's no point in defining it. And then the clause seeks to define words and expressions such as National Health Council, and you'll notice that as 1C, where it says National Health Council means National Health Council as established by Section 52, Subsection 1 of the National Health Act of 2003. Then it goes on to define the term prescribed as prescribed by regulations in terms of the Act. It also defines the term private health sector, and that's on the top of page 3, meaning private health sector means that part of the health sector that is not owned or controlled by an organ of state or defined in section 239 of the Constitution of the Republic. And it also makes an amendment to chief executive officer, and here that's on actually 1A, where it states chief executive officer means the chief executive officer of the service appointed in terms of section 13A. And previously it was chief executive management committee referred to in section 13, which really didn't give the meaning of what a chief executive officer was, so that amendment was not there to deal with that. If I can then go to clause 2. Clause 2 seeks to amend section 3 of the Act by including the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act 2000, thereby making provisions of the Act applicable to the service. So that's in section 3, where you see on page 3, it states amendment of section 3 of Act 37 of 2000. Subsection 3 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by substitution of subsection 2 of the following subsection of state under 2. The Public Finance Management Act of 1999 and the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act of 2000 apply with the necessary changes to the service. And then under B, it states by the addition of the following subsection, the board is the accounting authority of the service. So the reason for including these is that the NHLS legislation came in before the PFMA, and there was some perception, over time, that the PFMA doesn't apply to the NHLS. Well, people believe that. They said, well, show us in our Act where it applies. And it didn't make reference, although the PFMA did make reference that everybody has to comply. So here, just to make it explicit, that it does apply.
If I want to also to propose so that we are not left behind, if maybe as you are explaining, if it's fine with members, that if there's something you just want to leave it to, which is of priority. Because to me, I'm finding it a bit taken aback to have an institution like that, if I'm understanding you correctly, that it has conducted its business outside PFMA. what is it then they were told? And when they were audited, because my understanding is that the Auditor General, all entities are being asked then, it's something that is quite, so you, as you are saying, they were not then, when they were established, they were not covered, they were established before the establishment of the name of PSMEA. And I want to throw it back to the department, when the newspaper, why didn't the department pick this up? Because it's an entity. So if, was I'm raising this, honorable members, my apologies, but I want us to have a broader and a thorough understanding, because it is a complete hole if I am of this act, and therefore it's going to make us to have a broader and a more focused understanding of the importance of then this act being amended.
Chair, when we engage the Office of the Accountant General, they actually need a very detailed report about the gap, and it is on the basis of the work of the Accountant General that we come back actually to Parliament to say we need this amendment. It was triggered by the work that the Commission did.
Chair, if I go to clause 3 then, clause 3 proposes amendments to section 4, which is also on page 7, and it proposes amendments to basically clause 6 to insert the word diagnostic in paragraph 6, in paragraph 8, to ensure that the core mandate of the service is to provide diagnostic health laboratory services to the public, so that's very clear what the mandate is. And secondly, furthermore, in paragraph B of the section, that the word provide be replaced by the word support in order to reduce the burden on the service by giving the service a supporting role rather than the service being the provider of training for health science education. Because there are many health science students that have to be trained on the NHLS platform. But the NHLS is not an academic institution, it was a platform. So the way it was written previously was as if the NHLS became an academic institution. Provide the platform on which students that are registered in an academic institution get the practical training.
All right.
Clause 4 seeks to amend section 5 of the Act in order to make it clear that it is duty of the service to promote the training of its staff members. So in other words, that the NHLS has a responsibility very clearly for its staff members. In the case of others who need training, then clearly they will get into agreements with the NHLS about how they're training. Because clearly employees of the NHLS, there's a responsibility of the NHLS to fund the training of the staff members, fund the employer.
If I can just ask, where they were, if they were providing, if as we are, as they are now, they are providing training, where are they sourcing funds from for that training?
So the training that the NHLS does currently with staff members obviously sources that from internal funds, but the training of additional of academic training for health science students, that's being transferred to a grant.
Can I just I would put it this way, that NHLS has been short-changed, and that they do not benefit from the subsidies from the Department of Higher Education. Even though they provide the training platform, they do not get the subsidy, which I think is a problem. This is one of the things that we have to reform, the whole financing of NHLS, so that subsidy should also be made available training that is provided. The second is that for most of the disciplines in clinical training and the usage of the platform, we have two grants where we transferred funds to province. NHLS also doesn't benefit from that arrangement. So I think they've been shortchanged twice. And you are separating the training function, the actual service that is linked to the clinical management of patients, and also the oversight public health function with a surveillance to help us with a epidemic preparedness and response. So we're splitting those functions, and I think this is going to provide us with that opportunity.
Sorry, I hope members are able to follow. Feel free to ask if there is any way you think you are left behind. Thank you.
Chair, if I can go to clause 5. Clause 5 seeks to replace section 7 of the Act and provide for the composition of the board of the service. So in terms of the new section 7 of the board, the board will be made up of the chief executive officer by virtue of that person being the CEO. Secondly, the chief financial officer, the CFO of the NHS, will be a member. Then thirdly, three members representing the National Department of Health, the Department of Science and Technology, and then thirdly, the Department of Higher Education. Then three representatives of provincial departments, as well as six members who must have extensive experience in the field of commerce, finance, auditing and economic matters, corporate management, public health, diagnostic laboratory services, legal matters, and epidemiology. And it is proposed that the board is accountable to the Minister of Health. So that's under section 7 of the bill. Currently it's on page 3 of the document. So the intention here is to reform the NHLS board from what it is currently, which is largely a representative structure for provincial departments, to become a board like you have in the ambulance team, the Council of Medical Schools, and so that you can make the research.
And Chair, I apologize. One, we've not seen that representation to have been of benefit, particularly for a board that requires representative experience. Either one to sit on at a meeting, or if they can't meet, they don't have their documents. And for an institution that has one huge amount of money that requires checking of payments by provinces. Chair, you are aware that has probably been one voice calling for payment of accounts by NHLS. Now, it is actually the board's responsibility to do this. Now, if people don't show up in meetings, they don't have documents, or they have no clue what the institute is about, it is actually putting us at risk for doing a very important function.
Just on the point of clarity, Chair, am I correct to add up the numbers here? Like if we say the chief executive officer, the chief financial officer, I say 2, and then I go down, and then I have 3. That makes it 5. Am I correct? And then 3 representatives of provincial departments. That makes it 8. Now, if I could get clarity on how these 3, because we have 9 provinces, and if you could talk more on that one. And then, how many did I say? And then we have 6 below.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how how many does it make?
14.
Anything else? If it's gonna, yeah. If you could just give me that kind of, it means I'm correct the way I was interpreting, but just clarity on that one.
So yes, I think one of the challenges in the initialist currently is that many provinces battle to send an appropriate person to contribute valuably to the running of the organization. Mm-hmm. And so just having a provincial person there, or they're not attending meetings, are helpful. And so the clause D states that three representatives of provincial departments, after consultation with the National Health Council. So the minister will consult with the National Health Council with the nine provinces and agree on three people from those provinces participate.
Yeah, and one week when they come up
to three.
Thank you.
Take another
three representatives of provincial departments. So out of nine, they will have come up with three. No, maybe at some point when we're done, because one has to say, I doesn't have questions, I don't want to say. But I'm sure it's a functioning part of those who satisfy.
Just to say, at the moment, there are 22 board members, nine of whom are from the provinces. And one of the challenges on the board is they are there representing the provinces. And the question is, do they make board decisions in the interests of the NHLS or the interests of the provinces? So it's quite a problem when 9 out of 22 members are representing the main user and payer of the services. It doesn't give the board the kind of framework required to effectively fulfill its mandate. Whereas here, you'll still have the interests of the stakeholders and the users, the provincial experience and the input of challenges provinces face, suggestions they have, but you won't have a board where more than 40% of the members come out of the provinces, compared to 3 out of 14, 9 out of 22 is a big number.
Maybe let me be more blunt.
Before that, what you have asked, so that you respond.
Why, if you want to fix this, you still want to bring in provincial interest in this when we are talking about national structure?
Even after the board meetings, they don't go back to address the issues that were raised in the board. It's almost like they go attending. It's a dysfunctional arrangement. So the intention is to do that. Perhaps the question is, why three provinces? If you want, because you still need provincial input, but you don't need nine. And provincial input doesn't have to be a person, it's a person that understands the operations of NHLS in operational settings. So maybe the question is, do we need three or do we need one? And I agree with you.
But I still think that we need provincial input. But I don't think it should be online. And this is a, you know, a statement, because we've seen it doesn't work. The other point, Chair, that they also don't attend meetings, and I don't know if that has improved. And then you struggle with a problem of quorum when they don't attend meetings. So it's multiple problems that I'm experiencing.
If you happen to be from Gauteng and appointed to the board, that means you represent Gauteng.
Mm-hmm.
You represent the board. So now if you're going to say these three represent provinces and they all come from Gauteng, you are having a problem. So why not remove this thing of province and they are just members of the board and represent their interest?
Mm-hmm.
Does it make sense? Legal people are here. I'm taking this route, the honourable members, because as I've said initially, it's an act that is being overhauled. But secondly, it's an act that when we pass it as this committee, we are all. Understand, we have cleared. It doesn't come back again to us when there are challenges, that because of this it must be. So all the issues that we really want to ask and to get clarity from and to propose, I think we can do that now. I hope the Secretariat is fine, can guide us with that process, because I think this process that is in the action is precisely for that, for today. So the question from Honorable Maestel is that why say three provinces instead of just three representatives of the board? All right. Are we fine with that? Okay.
We move to the next one, Chair. Clause six proposes amendments to Section 8 of the Act in order to align that section with the amendments that have been proposed under. And it also proposes that the word "and" must ensure that appropriate laboratory professionals are appointed be omitted in Section 8.1 of the Act, as the members from the bodies and institutions referred to in Section 7 are not necessarily in laboratory.
But all of the members, they must also understand that we are asking clarity now. We are still going to deliver it as the committee. So it's at a later stage. So areas where you just want clarity, we request the department to do that. Thank you.
Chair, go to clause 7 then. Clause 7 seeks to replace Section 9 of the Act and provide for the appointment of the chairperson and vice chairperson of the board of the service and provide more detail about it. So the minister appoints a chairperson and a vice chairperson from the board from amongst the non-executive members of the board. However, the chairperson of the board, when the chairperson of the board is absent and unable to perform his or her function as chairperson, the vice chairperson must act as the chairperson. If the vice chairperson is absent or unable to act as the chair, the members must designate from among the members of the board a chairperson until the chair or the vice chair become available. The clause also proposes that in the event that the chairperson or vice chair is absent or unavailable for two consecutive meetings, that the board, in consultation with the minister, designate a member to act as chair or vice chair until such time as the chair or vice chair is available to resume his or her duties as a chair or vice chair. Mr. Chair, that is a procedural matter. Okay. It's on page 4, bullet clause 7. We go to clause 8, that's also on page 4. So clause 8 seeks to amend section 10 of the Act in order to provide that a member must vacate his or her office before he or she has been absent for two consecutive meetings of the board without the leave of the board. The current position is that the member is absent for more than two meetings without such leave. So basically, this amendment states that if it's for two meetings, that the member is then a mutual recusal member of the membership.
Most constitutions and what can you say? Practical experience say that if you miss three meetings, you are not brought to the fourth. But if you miss one, the second one, the third one, you say, no, I must go, otherwise I'll be out. So you will be disadvantaging people unless if you say two. Instead, practically and constitutionally, it's disadvantageous to say two. Maybe
it's
three. Correct.
Okay, I can go to the next one then. Clause 9. Clause 9 proposes the insertion of Section 10A in the Act and seeks to provide for the dissolution of the board by the minister under certain circumstances that the appointment of an interim board is further proposed that a new board must be constituted within 180 days of dissolution of the board. So the reason that this clause has been there, so just to give you a sense, is historically, when there were challenges with previous board constitution, the argument was that if the minister was not happy with the performance of the board, the minister had to go to court and apply for the dissolution of the board before appointing a new board. And so that obviously posed a huge problem. And so this clause intended to fix that.
Okay.
Going to clause 10 then, it seeks to amend section 11 of the Act by providing that the meetings of the board and the conduct of business at meetings must be determined by the rules, and that the replacement of the word prescribed with determined is necessary as a result of the amendments proposed in section 27 of the Act. In terms of those proposals, the minister will be empowered to prescribe certain matters by making of regulations. So I think the term prescribed and determined is the key issue.
Okay.
So moving to clause 11, it seeks to amend section 13 of the Act, providing that the chief financial officer must be appointed to the executive management committee of the board. Basically, just linking it to the previous clause that the CFO must be part of the executive. Clause 12 proposes the insertion of section 13A and B in the Act. Section 13A provides for the appointment of the chief executive officer to the board, and 13B for the functions of the CEO. Then, if I can move to clause 13, it seeks to amend section 18 of the Act by replacing the words income earned from fees for services rendered with fees collected in order to provide clarity on the nature and the source of funding. And that no person may be designated as an acting CEO for a period no longer than 180 days. This seeks to replace section 20 of the Act by providing that the service may charge such fees for services rendered as may be prescribed by the minister after consultation with the National Health Council and the Minister of Finance. In terms of the proposed definition of prescribed, the minister may, by regulations, prescribe the fees that may be charged by the service. that the service determines the fees after consultation. So the current arrangement is that the service proposes the fee to the minister approves and defends the agreement. So this is in line with what happens in many other institutions where the minister consults with the National Health Council, they agree on that, and the Minister of Finance also is part of that decision. So that when the fees are increased, it's in line with the general agreement. Can I move to clause 15, Chair, which seeks to repeal section 25 of the Act. The provision of that section became redundant as a result of the reception of 10A in the Act. So that section has been removed. So if I move to clause 16, which amends section 27 of the Act, this section is to be amended to allow the minister to make regulations regarding, amongst others, anything that must be prescribed in terms of the Act, and the minister must make the regulations after consultation with the National Health Council. And before the minister makes regulations, these regulations must be published in the Gazette for at least 1 month, calling for interested parties to submit comments. So this is just an alignment check to make sure that this is in line with all our other practices about how we conduct the process. Clause 17 here proposes transitional provisions in respect of the current board and CEO to the new board. And that's a new section, clause 17. Then if I move, Chair, to clause 18, which basically provides the short title and commencement date of the Act.
Maybe just a clarity about the clause 14, bullet 2, in terms of the proposed definition, the prescribed, the minister may regulate prescribed prescription, the regulation prescribed the fees that may be charged by the service. The current position is that the service determines the fees after consulting with the minister. Now, the minister does not need to consult anybody. How does he come to this determination to prescribe how much what must be paid?
So usually what happens is that the service determines what it anticipates would be its costs and expenditure in exploration. Proposes that to the minister. The minister discusses the National Health Council and looks at whether that is reasonable, appropriate, etc. The minister then shares that with the Minister of Finance to say this is what the assessment is, and we are in agreement with this, do you concur? If the Minister of Finance agrees, then the minister would then approve this.
No, but if it's not in the Act, how does it function when it is not in the Act? But if it's in the Act, then you're not going to argue about who did you consult.
I think in the Act it states here that the minister has to consult with the Minister of Finance.
We are still going to have our own Are there any clarities that is there? I just wanted to check how now becoming more one subject to understand what things I have not done and what is it that. That's I'm just going to be simple. If blood for full blood count is then prescribed and taken from me, how much is it charged by National Health Laboratory? Who determines this? I hope I'm just trying to be simple to for us to really have to understand this issue. Who determines the charge for a food blood count?
So the NHLS prepares its fee proposal based on a cost recovery basis, and then recommends an annual increase to the Minister of Health. And the Minister is the one who approves the annual increase based on the motivation from the board. That then also needs to be consulted with the provinces as well. So the Minister consults with the provinces. At the moment, some of the fees of the NHLS are a bit imbalanced. So in some we overcharge and in others we undercharge. But on the whole, we're a lot cheaper than the private sector anyway. So that's the process for the fees.
Before that, also, it is common knowledge that some of the things happen to the institution. I go in for a food blood count. I'm given TCA to come back. My results can be found. Reordering the same food blood count. Now, in terms of charges,
yes.
Because I've been food blood count has been done twice, and the same institution. That is going to go to the same institution as the NHLS. What do you do? I'm triggered by
sure.
This double charge.
So we'll start. I'm sure the Director General will talk about the development of the new patient identifier, which the NHLS will be involved in. So at the moment, we have two provinces that have already implemented the beginning of a unique patient identifier that will then prevent duplication of tests. At the moment, there is still duplication, and we're working on systems to offset that. In fact, we discussed this last week or the week before at the National Health Council Technical Committee with all the provincial heads of departments.
Such a key to this is the minimum fields on the request form that need to be filled in by the clinician. And when the clinician is not mandated to put in the unique identifier, it is often left out. Because of the high carriage of unique identifier with the ID book by South Africans, it may well be possible to insist that such a number is included, and that where we have people of foreign descent, that their passports can be added, and the new health patient unique identifier system, HPRS, is a step forward in that regard as well. But it is possible to insist upon this, and the provinces, I think, need to insist upon it, because it will be a major cost-cutting exercise for the NHLS as well.
There are two problems. One is that the provinces do not fill in the required fields. For instance, sometimes they don't even include the patient tickets. So obviously it means when the last results are sent back, they do not have details of the patient. So it's obviously a problem. The second is that sometimes even the doctor who ordered the blood test, the first, the details allergic to this. So I'm just saying, on one hand, the provincial submission of requisition forms is incomplete. On the other hand, the system on NHLS side does not pick up those indications that the fees are still being charged. So the simplest approach that we're working on, we did an analysis to look at, and maybe let me add another problem. If you look at the types of tests that are conducted at primary healthcare level, there are certain tests that can never be done at primary care level. They're for our academic institutions or for specialized services. But you'll get those types of requisitions. So we did an analysis of the type of test that you need at primary healthcare level and said this is a basket of tests that must be done at primary care level so that if deemed, if you get anything peculiar at that level, then you know that it shouldn't be done or any challenge should be able to reject it. So those are sort of the gatekeeping measures that have been put in place according to this. But in addition, you need to also have a sense of what are those tests that are high cost so that you can continuously monitor usage. So what Professor Book was saying is that they under recover in some instances because they charge less than they should. And then in some instances they over recover. Obviously it's a risk. So we are working on almost like a capitation based model that has some aspects of fee for service so that it brings a balance. And I think we've done considerable progress on developing that model. And in terms of this act, we need to link the two so that the system of cost recovery should not just be based on fee for service because it's quite costly. We've seen it even within the medical scene environment that fee for service drives utilization. So at some stage we'll come in addition to this, just share with you the system of costing and cost recovery that is being proposed.
From my side, DG, you go back that the purpose of this, I think you say you want it to be twofold. The purpose of this amendment is to ensure that the National Health Laboratory Services focuses on what they are then supposed to do, which is laboratory services. And then training being provided by the institutions that are necessary to do that. Now, in terms of funding, how are they going to be funded as an institution moving forward? So I just want to get that clarity. I'll tell you why maybe a bit confusing for me that this thing that NHLS was charging fees, using that, in that charging also using train, that is why we need training, that is why it was not utilizing PFMA. So it was just an institution that if it feels today that it must increase whatever, the more tests that are being done, even if a patient is, if I can exaggerate, is being done full blood count more than thrice, it's not important. It's important they charge. So it's the money that comes in, and which also they have to conduct training. Now, if then they are to focus on their core business, if I can use that word, training, is this bill also trying to exact where are they then going to get funding?
So let me explain. At the moment, on that cost recovery basis, NHLS does not just pay for its own staff and its expenses. It also has to cover NICD, NIOH, the National Cancer Registry. Now, if you look at what we are proposing, NICD, NIOH, National Cancer Registry, are the core business of government. It's institutions that different governments in different countries invest in, meaning it is what I say protects your country. It's when you have an Ebola outbreak, it's an institution that must be functional, that must be ready to respond. When you have cholera outbreak, it must be an institution. So what NHLS does on a cost recovery basis, meaning when they charge a problem, they have to recover money to cover the expenses, pay for their staff, but also make sure that they can also sustain these other institutions. So our view is that these institutions, there must be money available for, but remember they also have to make sure there's money for training, because they're not getting a subsidy. So we're splitting the two, and we're creating, when we present tomorrow, you will hear then about how we're putting these institutions under one body so that they get a direct budget, meaning they must be budgeted for. They cannot override on a cost recovery basis. They have the budget and they must do their work.
Okay.
And training and research.
Can I just get on a point of clarity? My understanding is that NAPISA will be talked about tomorrow. That will be the creation of this consolidated institute. But then in terms of the NHLS amendment bill, the objects of the service remain the same. And so their primary role is service, teaching, and research, as I understand it. They provide the laboratory health services, support health research, and support training. So just on point of clarity, my understanding is that the three pillars of the NHS will remain, even though there is a spinning out of NAPISA.
Yes, Chair, I think it's what we're saying is putting NHS at risk. You cannot use the cost recovery model to provide for training. It's what puts NHS at risk. That's why we're saying that training must be provided for, like for other disciplines. When you train people in cardiology, no institution does any cost recovery. Why must it be the case for pathology and other, you know, it's what is putting NHLS at risk. So if I were to paint a scenario, Chair, if you go to AMPAS, Lancet, these, now you go there, they take your blood, you get your results, it's the basis of diagnosis, they treat you and that's it. That's what NHLS receives. Now if that training platform is used for training students, then we need to look at what vehicles is available for training. They must have access to clinical training grant, they must have access to these other grants that we provide. The only difference is that the training platform is not a provincial health department. Now you also don't want a risk like we've seen with the five disciplines in KZN that have lost their accreditation because they couldn't feel home. It's a risk. It means you can't train people if you can't diagnose through your lab services, if you can't diagnose using your radiology services. You can't then run a health system. So we're separating those functions. The clinical care, you need an oiled machine.
Chair, I can just, we can also put it in the context of, remember that the NICD and the NIOH cost, cancer registry costs are generally fixed costs. They're not related to the laboratory costs, right? So if you want to fund that, you have to make sure you do enough tests and make enough of excess income in order to direct it there. So what happens tomorrow is there are less tests done, so that means there'll be a shortfall, right? That's not the way you want to fund an institution like NICD. She wants them to get direct access to funding so they don't depend on hoping that tomorrow everybody will order the right lab test so that they can get it.
Would that be correct if I say this at the moment? I think we'll create stability in the National Laboratory Services for us, because with the current situation, they were losing people that were not quite sure whether we're going to be paid at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
So this act is trying to address that. Am I correct in that?
Yes, Chair. In fact, I thought Professor Book will also refer to this, because this is the status at the moment. The budgeting system is that they count the number of tests that were conducted and then they do their costing. So like what Dr. Pile is saying, if there are fewer tests, then it means they're going to run at a risk. They won't be able to cost recover enough money to cover the expenses. It's a big risk. So one of the things that we're discussing with Treasury is that funding model, which is what we'll be finalizing, so that when this bill becomes an act, even the system of financing and interest will change. I think Professor Booth can also.
So, Chair, the situation is that the the PISA and merging the NICD and other institutions into NAPISA fulfill a very specific public health mandate for the country. And that's the one side, and it needs a specialized stream of funding like the Center for Communicable Diseases in the United States. In terms of the NHLS itself, the NHLS has three functions. It must provide laboratory services for the country, in particular for the poor, as opposed to for private sector users. Secondly, we have to provide a platform for the training of students in pathology and laboratory disciplines, much like like all the medical students train in hospitals, so we have to provide the same for pathology and laboratory services, that platform where people learn. And thirdly, all the university academic departments in the pathology disciplines, hematology, chemical pathology, and so on, train registrars and specialists and technologists in those disciplines, but they also do research. So we have a few hundred academic pathology staff whose responsibilities include research. So that's the three legs of the NHLS, and this bill continues those three legs. The funding of them, of each leg, is slightly different. So in terms of the laboratory services, the tests that come in that get assessed and provided, which includes training people on how to do them and how to do the work, that's a test that at the moment is paid for on a fee-for-service basis. So you do a test, you get a bill. If you do 100, you get 100 times that amount. And the problem to some extent with that is what you referred to earlier, is that it's very dependent on the provinces paying us and paying us on time. And if there are delays in provincial payments, it puts the NHLS at risk. And there has been a pattern of delayed and stalled payments from provinces to the NHLS. The second problem is always around the fact that we do thousands of tests. And how do you make sure that each test price is fair, that some are not overcharged, others undercharged? So the DG has been leading a process to create what is known as the Modified Capitated Reimbursement Model, MCRM, which basically has worked out the cost of the test and what the fee should be. And then the provinces will get a certain basket of tests, a certain amount of tests and a volume for that financial year at a certain price. And then that can be paid. And that does a number of things. It creates stability for the NHLS. But also what it does is it saves us the costs of running a billing system that says for every test you've got to do, here's the bill and the province is checking and that. it makes it a simpler, more effective billing system that creates stability. That's the for the laboratory test. The academic platform that we provide, we work on a rough model that says that for senior academic staff, the pathologists who are professors and heads of department, we say that they spend 50% of their time on laboratory services, providing, you know, the chemical pathology or virology tests, and the other 50% of their time is spent on the academic responsibilities, teaching and research, training for the future, and therefore, and for more junior staff, it's 70% service, 30% academic. So what we're working towards is a model where the academic time is subsidized, is paid through a conditional grant, the same way as the provinces get a conditional grant for that purpose. We want to bring the NHS in line, because we don't want provinces with their equitable share paying for what is a central national function of training. They should not be overcharged for their test in order to subsidize the training of students. That is a national function that should get a conditional grant the same way as the provinces do. And then the third stream of income will be research grants, where our professors apply for a research grant, they get research funding, and that helps to fund the research side. Because provinces constitutionally are not funded. They're funded for service provision in the health sector. They're not funded to fund critical research in the country. So what is happening is that we are putting in place, we're not changing the fact that the NHLS will become like a private laboratory service that just does as many tests as it can to make as much profit as possible. That's the private sector. We are a national public entity serving the country and with a particular focus on serving the poor. And we provide all the services in all the public hospitals and clinics in the entire country. So we serve 83% of South Africans. And our job is to do that at the lowest cost in the most efficient manner possible. We're not there to make surplus and profits out of this. And therefore, we will continue to fulfill those three responsibilities. Laboratory, provision of laboratory services and pathology services for the country. Number two, the training of pathologists and laboratory technicians and technologists, a platform for that, and relevant research to advance services in the country. That research will be public health research, it will be diagnostic research, depending on the different disciplines. And what the DG is leading is a process to correct historic anomalies in the funding model and risks in the payment practices. This act will enable that process further. I'm sorry it was a long explanation, but I thought we needed to establish that foundation.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to find out what is the current situation with regard to the suspension of the CFO and the CEO, and with regard to the composition of the board, why the organized labor is not part of the board? And my last question, how will this transitional provision be in effect?
Thank you, Chair. I hope that maybe NHI will solve this problem. You are at pain to explain why you give somebody money to go and pay for something and you mustn't pay much and things like that, and you are doing a service and things like that. 1 or 2 hours without with that. It's simple and much easier. You don't have to give me money to go and pay and then you say you pay too much and so on. And you can do away with that. Give them what they need, they do the work, and that's it. They get paid for doing the work, and we're doing a service to the people, we are not doing anybody a favor. So maybe then all this problem of who's fixing what prices and what payment and give who much money, unless you just want to know that you're giving Gauteng so much money, you pay so much money for the tax in Gauteng. There are too many people there anyway. And then Mpumalanga, you gave less money for accounting purposes. But you can do that without actually having to have bills and things like that replicating. I don't know. It's just that it's like wanting to do something and do it over and over again, but the same thing, and the result is the same, the outcome is the same. I would suggest that now, when you've got a chance like this to fix things, why not fix them once and for all instead of incremental? We'll fix them in future as they come. Thank you.
So on the matter of the CEO and the CFO, just to update you since my previous presentation of the strategic plan to the committee, the CEO, CFO, and supply chain manager were all suspended in response to serious procurement and other irregularities, the details of which I requested the chair not to oblige me to divulge because we don't want to jeopardize the cases against them. The dates for the CEO, CFO and CEO's hearings were set. As you know, with legal advisors, there are many tricks of the trade that they use. And 2 days before the first hearing, they came with about 5 to 6 page list of documents that they wanted us to provide. And we provided them, and then they came and said they hadn't had time to study them. So the presiding officer gave a 2 week extension for the next set date. And 2 days before that, they came with another list. This time, the first one was for the CFO's case, and now they came with the CEO's case. So we provided that, and we are now moving on to another date, which is taking place around about now. The situation there, though, is that we have appointed outside counsel, both as the presiding officer, as well as to present the case on behalf of the NHS. So I personally have been extensively involved together with the acting CEO and the company secretary and the governance committee of the board on briefing the attorneys, so they're fully versed with the matter, and to ensure that we proceed. The supply chain manager's hearing was has just taken place. They arrived at the hearing, and he handed in his resignation to avoid the charges, and has offered to and this is confidential, but he's offered to testify in the other cases as well. So we are busy still dealing with it because there are other matters pertaining. We can't simply resign to avoid matters, so we're busy as a governance committee dealing with that situation. We have also suspended the head of internal audit. The main charge against him was around misleading the board in the production of his internal audit reports requested by the board that effectively covers up some of the procurement irregularities, and we're still in the process of setting a date for his hearing. The CEO and CFO took the NHLS to the CCMA, initially saying they wanted their suspensions lifted and to return to their jobs. I personally went because it involves the CEO, the chairman of the board, it's my responsibility, and we
explained why there was no possibility of us lifting the suspension and then returning to their posts. And we have now been called to an arbitration. And we're looking at the legal situation in regard to an arbitration in the face of disciplinary hearings that are proceeding. But what I can assure you is that the board is absolutely committed, and I think that you're all aware that these kind of things often drag on for years before the case is heard. And I think that it's a compliment to the board of the NHLS that has moved very decisively on these matters, and within a few months, of identifying the irregularities, that the disciplinary cases have been prepared, completed, fully prepared, and are proceeding. Maybe I should also just say that we are also aware of our responsibilities in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, and the matter has been reported in full to the Chief Procurement Officer, and obviously we're awaiting an appointment to, I always forget the new official title, but to meet with senior people in the police service for the investigation from their side of the violations of the Public Finance Management Act. We felt that the advice was better to rather wait a little while and meet the senior people rather than simply go and hand in an affidavit at the local police station that disappeared. So I trust that brings you up to speed on the matter.
One question about labour.
Sorry, my apologies. Let me also say that there are we are not saying that those four are the only executives or staff members involved, and we are continuing the process of investigating these. I should also maybe just reassure you as well, as I did last time, that we have an acting CEO in place, Professor Shabir Mardi. He didn't join us today because he's about to travel to a major meeting in Geneva at the World Health Organization. So he's not here today, but the acting CEO and CFO have been doing excellent work. Board members have been putting in extra time, and the NHLS has done probably better than it was previously in managing the organization and dealing with a number of the challenges. So just to reassure you that the NHLS has challenges around the financial issues you spoke about and other areas, but I think we've been, over the past 6 months, I think certainly that I can comment in detail on, I think the NHS made major progress in dealing with a number of issues and areas, including these procurement irregularities.
Yes, Chair, I thought Professor Gokul mentioned that currently we do have a labor rep on the NHLS board. Perhaps my view is that tenure should continue. And even with the current labor negotiations, we are fully appealing, including these processes that Professor Gokul has been referring to. Chair, we've looked at the funding model for NHLS, and frankly, it's not sustainable. And our accreditation model, it's somehow linked to a budgeting system of some sort. And the problem, we can't follow that up that the law, as it stands, provides for a cost recovery model. It means NHLS must charge for its service. Now, because this is how the law was written, one of the reasons we need to amend is that specific provision that imposes on NHLS that it should charge a fee. So this is going to fix what we just referred to, not even NHL, but just this law. Just amending this can help us with the cost recovery. Chair, the minister may not have briefed you, or we have been working with the chair on these matters. As you know, the minister has to agree with the processes of NHLS. So the suspension and so on has been quite supportive.
More than that.
I was just going to say, Chair, even before the investigations, we had already started, because we got some signals that all was not well with the service. So we've been working
No, thank you very much for that explanation. Yes, Honourable Members, the Chair of the Board did take us through the situation, but requested that they won't go into detail. But with the understanding that these matters, they take long, our concern was in hope that it won't impact negatively on the management and the leadership of the institution itself, and we were reassured that no, that is not going to happen. We are raising these questions and these concerns, DG, because it is our belief, a strongly belief, that these are the institutions, among others, that are to ensure that the sector is able to provide its services to the people of South Africa. Where's those that are in the public institutions? The poor can't afford to go to a private laboratory. So we'll forever be on edge, wanting to under the edge. What's around the issue of governance? Because governance is the key. It's our belief, let alone that people talk a number of things. It's our belief as a government led by the African Union Congress that there must be clean governance. And we will not be apologetic in some areas where we think that is not happening, because it then means the ordinary people on the streets are then going to suffer. So we on behalf of the committee, I think we are comfortable that there was that swift reaction where issues of disciplinary, they drag, but as long as there is then going to be a management and leadership that is ensure that the institution does not collapse. And we hope that the Department of Health is always going to be monitoring that situation. There was a view sometime last year, if I'm not mistaken, that we think that as a committee, when we conduct oversight, we must also visit the entities, because we only conduct oversight in provinces in terms of the institution. But we must have we will see if our programs and our work allows us to do that, but it will really be very important to just have that interaction and see how the entities are functioning. I thought I must just respond on the I was responding on the issue about the challenges around the CFO.
Chair,
No, Madam Chair, I didn't want to say it up front myself, but once it's been raised by yourself, the Minister and the DG have been exemplary in their support for us, and they've made it absolutely clear that they want this matter handled to ensure clean governance, and that anyone who has abused or mismanaged public funds must be dealt with fully and efficiently, and they've backed us totally on that. Dr. Pillay has provided guidance for us along the way in terms of issues like the Chief Procurement Officer. The Chief Procurement Officer's office was also very helpful when we reported. So I think that, you know, and in my responsibility as the Chair, I ensure that the Minister, the DG and the DDG are all kept constantly abreast of developments in these cases.
Okay, just on a separate note, but in relation to the NICD arm, I thought I should raise it today. You may recall, Chair, that as part of the life FCC menu disaster, people had to be moved from the NGOs back to the institutions that are appropriate for their care. And the NICD Emergency Operating Center was used for that purpose. I thought I needed to mention that if it wasn't for that service, this move would not have been possible. So, because the Emergency Operating Center is normally used for when we have outbreaks, like Ebola and so on. So the idea was to use EOC as like we're in an emergency. And indeed, it performed that function very well. In fact, it has also improved their processes in that it has also established a certain level of readiness. In the event we have any other outbreak, it's a platform that can be used. And I think we pride ourselves with this service that is available to the nation.
All right. Thank you very much, DG. I think all I remember is all our clarities that we wanted to sort it out in terms of this. They have been. We are still going to have time within ourselves. I hope we've noted all the responses. We are meeting again tomorrow, DG, on the new NAPISA. So we will still, I do hope that, and I think members do have the copy of the bill, which is Bill 16, and we obviously will get the presentation. I do think, and I'm informed by the Secretariat that the presentation has been emailed to all members. Please check your gadget. We are now going to be, honorable members, we have come to the end of for today. But for honorable members' attention, will be at 2 o'clock, will be at G26 for our joint meeting with appropriations, G26. And I've also informed that report has also been circulated to all members. The report that we'll be dealing with in terms of the joint meeting with the appropriations. Otherwise, thank you very much. Until we meet again.